The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, I have 9:50, so I want to go ahead and start to make sure we make the most use of our time. I'm sure other people will be trickling in. I hope you left breadcrumbs on the way to and fro. That's the main conference. This is the secondary conference in the underbelly of this tower. The seminar is Singing the Lord's Song. What shall we sing? I want to give you a quick introduction of a quick bio. I grew up as a musician. Both of my parents were musicians. My mom taught piano for years. I heard the same songs again and again every week, you know, because she taught lessons in our home, even before I started playing piano myself. I, like Mozart, I was an early composer. Unlike Mozart, who was writing concertos, I wrote pieces like Elephant Taking a Bath. Played in church, did band, did drum and bugle corps, studied music in college, but also studied classical languages and also literature as well. Unusual Bachelor of Arts degree, which allowed me to not focus on one particular area, but to do everything from opera chorus to vocal jazz to trombone, orchestra, wind ensemble, etc. So a wonderful spread of opportunities there. I've taught, I've got a master's in composition. I've written for congregation hymns and psalms, as well as a couple film scores and a couple musicals as well. I've taught for 24 years in classical schools, everything from English to literature to theater to music, geometry, aesthetics, etc., symbolism and quadrivium as well. Because of my background and interest, I tell you all that just because when I talk about music, I'm coming from the perspective, not just as a musician, but from a historic, classical, literary, aesthetic, and ecclesiastical perspective, drawing all those things together. As one of the founders and president of New College, we've been able to flesh some of these things out in our studies in the quadrivium, and we'll talk about more of that on Saturday. I'll talk about that. I don't know if you'll be there or not, but you're welcome to come. But this is kind of the background and the perspective from which I'm drawing. So just to give you a sense of that. So now my question for you too is: how many of you are music educators? How many of you are administrators? Did that cover everybody? How many of you just love music? Okay, yeah, good. Good. So this is not intended as a pun, but in some ways this is preaching to the choir a bit. But I hope to give you a sense too of a broader and deeper perspective of why we do what we do. Why music is not just important but essential to a classical curriculum, why it's not an extracurricular, why it's not something that gets added on. For years, people come up to me at conferences and ask questions like, I've just been hired as my school's music director, and I need to know where to start. And I'd ask questions like, okay, how old is the school? Well, we're about 7 years old, and you're the first music instructor. Yes. The board feels like it's time and important that we spend energy on this right now. Like, okay, well, sadly, you're 7 years a little late. How much time do you have a week to teach music? 45 minutes. Like, okay. The understanding, the foundation of why we do music, you wouldn't have that same conversation about algebra. Can you imagine that same conversation about algebra? Yeah. So I've written a little fable, so if you'll indulge me, it'll be story time here. After weeks of working through the language, ideas, and allusions in Dante, the 11th grade literature students have come to the place where connections and understanding are coming together. Through class discussion, writing assignments, and references to other disciplines, they catch a glimpse of cosmological wonder as they contemplate the love that moves the spheres. The struggle has been worth it. They talk excitedly as they move from the literature classroom to school assembly and chapel. As they settle in for the chapel talk, Mr. Waterdown moves to the podium and reads a chapter from The Shack, with such use of language on page one as, "The god of winter was about to relinquish its hard-won dominion without a tussle," and he paused frequently listening to the sound of crystalline rain tinging off his window. And my favorite, "The icy rain pellets stung his cheeks and hands as he carefully worked his way up and down the slight undulations of the driveway. He looked, he supposed, like a drunken sailor gingerly heading towards the next watering hole. When you face the force of an ice storm, you don't exactly walk boldly forward in a show of unbridled confidence. Bluster will get you battered. Mac had to get up off his knees twice before he was finally hugging the mailbox like some long-lost friend." In the past, Mr. Waterdown had read selections from Spurgeon, Jonathan Edwards, and Augustine during chapel, but some of the parents had complained that those authors were too difficult, and at their churches, the students were more used to topics and readings that spoke to them where they are, like devotionals written by teens, for teens, God's Not Dead movie tie-ins, the hip-hop prayer book, and there really is such a thing, Heaven is for Real, and various Amish romance novels. Surely in the context of chapel, we don't want to ask the students to think too much. We can just satisfy their emotional preferences. What are some of the possible reasons or arguments why Mr. Waterdown might make these decisions? We don't want education to feel too stuffy, perhaps. The Shack is popular and the students really enjoy it. The Shack is part of our culture and we need to be exposed to it. The content of what we read doesn't really affect the students. Students and faculty have different preferences, and we should have a representation of different reading that meets the needs of those preferences. Students are more engaged with something that readily speaks to them. Or maybe he didn't really think about it at all. If students are reading Dante in the classroom, what kind of dichotomy or effect does it have on them if in school chapel they are read selections from The Shack or from Twilight or something else? We will have created false assumptions in competing categories of literature. One type is for education, the other type is to enjoy, which essentially turns education into a commodity. I read certain things because I'm graded on them, or I get some certain result. This forms a disconnect between what we value as education and what we enjoy, as opposed to training affections and right-ordered loves, as Augustine would say, such that what we enjoy are those things which are good and true and beautiful. This works both ways. Is what we teach in the classroom just because we're supposed to? You know, a classical curriculum should include Homer, Augustine, Dante, Shakespeare. Or is it because we love Homer, because we love Augustine, because we love Dante and Shakespeare? Have we developed a love for those things and what we teach? Because they're also worthy of that affection, because they're worthy of study, and because they provide a pathway to train the affections of students towards a right-ordered love. So let me retell our fable. After weeks of working through the language, ideas, and allusions in box art of the fugue, the 11th grade extracurricular music class has come to the place where connections and understanding are coming together, and they catch a glimpse of grandiose wonder as they contemplate the reflective design and order of the cosmos and its creator. The struggle has been worth it. They talk excitedly as they move from their classroom to school chapel. As they settle in for chapel, the worship team leads the school in such lyrics as, "When I'm in your arms is when I feel the best. My heart beats for you. We believe, greater things, greater things, greater things, greater things. I'm a friend of God. I'm a friend of God. I'm a friend of God. He calls me friend." And the poor analogy of, "And like a flood, his mercy rains." Flood is here, rain goes this way. In the past, students in chapel had sung psalms, historic hymns, and new music written in the traditions of history in the church. But some of the parents had complained that those songs were too difficult, and at their churches, the students were more used to music that spoke to them where they are, like Hillsong and songs in major keys with 3 to 4 chords. Surely in the context of chapel, we don't want to ask the students to think too much. We can just satisfy their emotional preferences. Now, I meant to say at the beginning that I may step on toes, and I'm sorry. It's not personal. And hopefully I haven't yet. Why does the first fable seem far-fetched with regards to talking about literature in that regard, and unlikely in our educational settings? And why does the second fable seem uncomfortably plausible, or perhaps even familiar? Do we value literature and other parts of the curriculum differently than music? Yes. I'll go ahead and answer that. Yes. So I want to address the following. What is the purpose of music and how does it work? What role does music have in a classical school curriculum? How do we decide what to sing and play? And how can music not only enhance but be a foundational part of the educational process? As I said before, the handout is less of an outline than it is a roadmap. The opportunity not to have to write everything down, but to give you a sense of where we're going. So the purpose of music education, training, forming affections, this is a key point. How much we understand about music and its purpose will determine how much we value it. So if we have an understanding, a fully orbed understanding of the purpose of music, I'll get to this in more detail, but just to give you an overview here, the difference between what happened with regards to our understanding of music pre-Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment is considerable. When you separate the idea of there being anything metaphysical, that you're pointing towards anything else, all you're left with is the sense of emotion or personal preference. You don't have the sense that there is pointing to something that's greater and beyond. And that's very much part of why that's different with how we even think about music. Most of the music that gets taught in curriculum or that's part of music appreciation programs is music from the last 250 years. And it's primarily post-Enlightenment music. It's primarily post-Enlightenment concert music within a secular setting that makes a difference. Just hold that thought, and we'll come back to some of those things later. So with regards to early music education, the Greeks talk about music in two different ways. There's music paired with gymnastics, which is essentially training of the body and the training of affections. It's education in the muses, not just music, but the nine muses. So when they speak of that, the nine muses are the daughters of memory, which is significant. So along with lyric poetry, history, astronomy, and tragedy, music was part of the foundational and fundamental basis of education. As the daughters of memory, the role of these muses was to train the affections of students, to train them in beauty, to enculturate them with virtuous stories, and to develop aesthetic sensibilities. That's what a museum is for. To collect, preserve, and pass along a culture. The muses help us remember. The muses help situate our story in what has gone on before. The muses train us in those things that are worthy of knowing. The purpose of music, then, was to point to the heavens. It was to reflect the order of the created cosmos, to mirror and create harmony or harmoniousness. Therefore, music was not about self-expression. It was not about personal identity or base emotions, commercialization, subjective tastes, mass youth culture, or ivory-towered academia. On Saturday, I'll address the idea of music within the quadrivium in much greater detail, but a little background will help as well. The idea of music paired along with arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy as part of the four aspects of the quadrivium is that they build upon one another. They reflect one another. There are interconnections between those, and they work together as a whole. It's understanding the world by means of number and order, and the fact that there is a created order. The universe is knowable, and music is an aspect of knowing not only what God has made, but part of the nature and character of who He is. Music serves to form our affections because of the way it embodies and incarnates God's creation, and thus points to His characteristics in nature. That's a much weightier and heavier purpose for why we sing, why we teach music, why we instruct students along those lines, as opposed to what do I like, what pleases me. When we lose the cosmic perspective of harmony, it changes how we form our affections. Let me give some examples of this. I mean, you've got some of this on your sheet there. Music disconnected from the cosmos. So you get to the subjective aspect of that. How does this play out? Lewis talks about this in his approach to art in An Experiment in Criticism. He writes, speaking specifically about visual art here, "The result, as I now see, was that I attended very inadequately to what was actually before me. It mattered intensely what the picture was of, hardly at all what the picture was. It acted almost as a hieroglyph. Once it had set my emotions and imagination to work on the things it depicted, it had done what I wanted. Prolonged and careful observation of the picture itself was not necessary. It might even have hindered the subjective activity. The emphasis is on what may be called the narrative qualities of the picture. You don't lay yourself open to what it, by being in its totality precisely the thing it is, can do for you." Think about this from the perspective of looking at a great piece of art. I was at the museum in Nashville several years ago, taking a group of students through. I think you were on there, part of the group. Yeah, yeah. Maybe we remember this. They had docents leading tours, and the docent was walking around saying, "Well, and there's Monet, and of course we know about Monet. Next." But we got to a picture of a painting of a ballerina by Degas, and she said, "The picture of a ballerina, do any of you dance?" Picture of a ballerina and dancing and so on. And so there's nothing about the artistry or how the painter created the work of art. It was all about what's going on in this picture. Are you part of that group? Do you remember that? Yeah. And even because of that, she got wrong what was going on in particular works of art, because she was looking at the narrative of the artwork and not the quintessential aspects of what makes a painting a painting. How do you use light and darkness? How do you use color? How does the artist draw your eye to one thing or another? The same is true with music. Too often we think about music from a narrative perspective. And God bless us, with the amount of time that some of us have in teaching students, there's not much more we can do other than give them some sort of sense of this is worth listening to. And to do so, let's engage your emotions or engage some sort of story, because that's about all the time that we have. But there's a big difference in thinking about and teaching music as music than we do teaching it as a soundtrack to other thoughts, as a sense of narrative, and understanding, as Lewis says, the totality precisely of the thing it is. That music works as music distinctively in ways that other arts do not. It engages your brain in other ways, in ways that other arts do not. It's significant in that way, and we truncate that. Lewis also talks about music in Experiment and Criticism as well. Once again, swelled by the emotion of it, the performance, the piece itself, kind of fades away, which is precisely what you ought not to do in terms of being able to recognize the music as music. The next section there, pleasing the audience, new fashion. I said a second ago the idea of music for the secular stage as opposed to the church. There's a wonderful book by James Gaines called Evening in the Palace of Reason, talking about Bach and Frederick the Great. And in that, he talks a lot about what music was like pre-Enlightenment. But this quote from this book: "For Bach, this new so-called gallant style with all its lovely figures and stylish grace was full of emptiness. Bach's cosmos was one in which the planets themselves played the ultimate harmony, a tenet that had been unquestioned since the sacred science of Pythagoras. Composing and performing music was for him and his musical ancestors a deeply spiritual enterprise whose sole purpose, as his works were inscribed, was for the glory of God. For Frederick, the goal of music was simply to be agreeable, an entertainment and a diversion, easy work for performer and audience alike. He despised music that, as he put it, smells of the church." Imagine if the literature that we taught in our schools were that which were agreeable, an entertainment, an easy work for the reader. That's not what we're after in other areas of the curriculum. But sadly, too often, that's where we're left with in terms of the crumbs of in the time and the schedule to do music. The other aspect is self-expression, personal soundtrack. Your students cannot imagine a world in which you didn't have, well, a Walkman, but or an iPod or some sort of personal music device. That's revolutionary the fact that you can carry music with you wherever you go, your own music that's separated from everybody else. The fact that you can enjoy music without having to make it or see somebody make it, that you're not participatory. The fact that what your music is reflects who you are. And so you've got your personal choices, well, as opposed to the popular things that you're supposed to listen to because your friends are. But it becomes very much an aspect of who you are and not an objective opportunity to understand what music is itself. And because of that, the next one, it becomes an aspect of self-identity. People get very sensitive about their music, right? If you criticize a band that somebody likes, you will get an immediate reaction, right? I'm seeing nods and smiles. You know this. It is like sexuality in a way. I had a conversation with Ken Myers years ago, and he said it's people's association and identity with music is unassailable. You cannot question that because they immediately get defensive. It is part of who they are, and they react very strongly. This happens all the time within the context of the church as well. Untrained people in music will come up to trained musicians and tell them what they're doing wrong with regards to music. I've been there. I've been in the receiving end of that. Or how you should play something differently or what music you should use. There's a sense that everybody has a right to express their opinion about music, whereas in other areas of life, you wouldn't. You would assume that somebody that has years of experience and study and degree and, that they would have some sort of sense of professional courtesy in that regard. But when it comes to music, there's a very personal aspect that people feel the right and the opportunity to speak their mind and tell you when you're wrong. It's very emotionally driven. We look for music to move us in films, in worship, in nostalgia, in dancing. Ken Myers also said, "We've turned over the musical education of our children to corporations who prey upon the emotions and hormones of teenagers in order to make money." It's a strong statement, but I think it's very true. It's a commercialized venture in which they are preying upon our children for business purposes. So what is the inheritance of music then? That's the negative side of what we've lost from a cosmological perspective. But from the cosmological perspective of what music used to be and what we should be, I think, striving to regain, is the fact that it reflects God's order. There's an objectivity to what music is. And I put several of these quotes on just because they're wonderful and you don't want to hear me read a bunch of quotes. But Athanasius's quote, which I will read, "It is right that creation should exist as he made it and as we see it happening, because this is his will, which no one would deny. For if the movement of the universe were irrational and the world rolled on in random fashion, one world would be justified as disbelieving, that we may say. But if the world is founded on reason, wisdom, and science and is filled with orderly beauty, then it must owe its origin and order to none other than the word of God. Nothing exists without music," says Isidore Seville. And Kepler, the end of that one, it's a longer quote talking about six-part texture and counterpoint. But he said part of the beauty of music is that for the fraction of an hour, and thus vicariously savoring the Creator's delight in his work through the delicious feeling of bliss that music, as it copies God, imparts to him. There's a connection point to what it is that God has made. As Romans 1 says, God has revealed himself in the things that he's made. And because of that, music has a weight to it that reflects those things. Cosmological harmony was actually one of the few ideas that philosophers, scientists, and theologians up until the Enlightenment time agreed upon. This was the foundation and the purpose of music. This is why Plato talks about certain music that should and shouldn't be sung within the context of the Republic. We read some of those statements, we wonder, that's kind of weird. I mean, what's the big deal? Or even some of the early church fathers. You need to recognize, too, that when the early church talks about music, they're not talking about what we think of as music. They're thinking of music from a cosmological perspective. They're talking about music with regards to how it is affecting people around them. So an interesting example of this, just last year, Putin in Russia sought to ban American rap music in Russian culture because he saw that as a... a negative influence upon the culture of the youth of Russia. Now, the West goes crazy about that in terms of freedom of speech and, you know, leaving Putin aside for a moment. But that impulse, that desire, that recognition is very much in line with a pre-Enlightenment view of the power of music. Every reason persuades us to believe that the world is composed with harmony, said Zarlino in his Institution of Harmony. So the other aspect of that, too, is that the purpose of music sustains God's order. Now, stick with me a bit on this one. The idea is that in music or in life, you're either creating concord or discord. You're either creating things that are harmonious or you're causing things that are broken. Think for a moment. I'm just going to assume that whatever situation you're in a homeschool co-op or in a school, at some point you've had some sort of disruption, right? There's been some sort of situation that has arisen. There has been a break. There has been discord. And that discord spreads. The difference is in harmony, even in the context of music. Things that are harmonious breed harmoniousness. The idea of harmony reflecting the harmony of the soul. And we'll actually talk about some of that on Saturday. The music has a purpose not only communally, but also individually in terms of our hearts, of uniting our hearts. So there's that whole aspect then of either working towards harmony or causing discord. And that brings us to the idea of harmonia or peace, the rightness of all things. The study of music, specifically in the context of the Quadrivium, moves us towards the idea of the biblical concept of shalom. Theologically speaking, in the context of the garden, in which, you know, things were the way that God made them to be. This is, you know, without the fall, communion with God, communion with one another. Sin came, that's broken. Peace comes through the blood of the cross. Christ is redeeming relationships. He has redeemed our relationship with God. He's redeeming relationships one to another. There's multiple verses in Scripture talking about live in harmony with one another in the epistles. As well, he's redeeming the cosmos. And all those things then are reflected in music. As Cassiodorus wrote, music indeed is the knowledge of apt modulation. If we live virtuously, we are constantly proved to be under its discipline. But when we commit injustice, we are without music. The heavens and the earth, indeed, all things in them which are directed by a higher power, share in the discipline of music. For Pythagoras attests that this universe was founded by and can be governed by music. This is why Shakespeare talks about, you know, he who does not have music within him. Ode to St. Cecilia's Day, untune that string. The idea that the loss of harmony causes discord, not just in terms of musical performance, but it's reflective of relationships, of society, of the broader culture. There's also the aspect of the creation mandate. Music and creating music is taking dominion over time and over sound. Part of that means, too, that what a composer was trying to do with Bach and Prior is to be able to successfully develop and execute the inherent potential, the objective inherent potential that a musical idea held. And so therefore you could judge a piece on its success as to how well it fulfilled that purpose. So for example, you know, you look at some of the works of Bach, for example, in which he has taken other people's music and rewritten it. Sometimes that's, you know, he doesn't have enough original ideas. No, what he's doing is actually taking a good idea and making it better, because the composer who came up with a good idea was not necessarily able to take it to its full fruition. Just because, you know, Copland talks about this, just because somebody has a beautiful melody does not necessarily make them a great composer. Think Tchaikovsky for a moment. You know, he has beautiful melodies and then has no idea what to do with them except repeat them. Because he doesn't develop them. He's not the level of composer to be able to take that to another level. Which, you know, the aspect of composer too at this time was more akin to the idea I guess I'm going down this trail, sorry. It's more akin to the idea of alchemy, in that it was knowledge that that was passed down one to another. It's not just a fact of anybody can be a composer. I live in Nashville, well, south of Nashville. There are so many people who make their living in the area of music who cannot read music. That would be unknown to the idea of the ancients, that to be, to embody music, to live in that and to work in that, you would necessarily know the rudiments and the fundamentals of that. And so it was an art form that you had to kind of earn the right to participate in. It's something that you worked towards. It's embodied as well. You think about how music is used in battle, in chanting and rowing, in David and Saul, the ways in which choir members have synchronized heartbeats, how sound waves move one to another. I'm speaking, and it's actually moving through you. You know, there's a sense in which we are together on this. There's a collective. When you sing in a choir, it's a unique experience to be inside a piece of music and to be making that music with other people, because your voices are greater than the sum of the parts. Did I say that right? Always get it went backwards. It's greater. It's good. Because what you're doing adds to one another. And then, you know, scientifically, you know, with regard to physics, that aspect too of when you're singing in tune, you are actually creating more notes than what you are singing. So it is amplifying what you're doing, even from the level of physics in there. It's communal. It's taken for granted throughout the whole history of the West. It was a defining human activity, and therefore every educated person was trained in music. Luther talks about the fact that no one should be a pastor if they're not also trained in music. To give you an idea, too, I mean, the where Bach was teaching in Leipzig, just on that edge between educational philosophies, Enlightenment, etc., a generation after he died, all the music classes and all the study and all the provision of musicians for the churches in Leipzig, all that part of the curriculum was gone. So within one generation. And so it's that quick how we can lose these ideas. Also the aspect of submission and humility. What is good for you? We do this all the time in other areas. You know, we recognize the fact that if you're going to get into shape, if you're going to read great literature, you have to submit yourself to a discipline and things that are good for you. As Lewis talks about, it's a good rule after reading a new book never to allow yourself another new one until you've read an old one in between. Would that we would do the same with music. Would that our teenagers would do the same with music. Between every piece they listen to, they're actually getting a foundation and understanding of the context of where this fits into the history. So this goes back to the idea then of training our affections. Jonathan Edwards writes, "The affections are no other than the more vigorous and sensible exercises of the inclination and will of the soul." And as Scott Annual writes in Worship and Song, "Affections, on the other hand, involve the mind. They arise as a result of some sort of cognitive understanding of truth. They are not immediate but developed. They are not merely surface-level physical responses. They support the intellect. Affections are so important to develop because we need noble affections to keep our passions in check. Without biblical affections, passions will always win over the mind." That's the purpose, that was the understood purpose of why we teach music. Knowledge must match our emotional engagement. Stratford Caldecott writes in Beauty for Truth's Sake, "In modern times we have neglected the poetic or musical dimension that was presupposed in the liberal arts as originally practiced and infused into the Middle Ages. The need to educate the heart and the imagination, not just to feel, but to know." When music was freed from numerical control, new sensual appeals were created which changed the focus and the perception of music. The morality of music was no longer as great a concern. We're not even used to talking about the idea of the morality of instrumental music. When we talk about the morality of music, we're talking about the content of the lyrics more often than not, or the general culture, right? When we talk about, Francis Schaeffer's categories of form and content, more often than not, that's utilized with the idea of the music is the form, the lyrics are the content. As opposed to thinking of lyrics as having form and content, music having form and content, and the marriage between the two of them also embodying an aspect of form and content. It's hard for us as a culture to even talk about the content of music or the truth of music. We can talk about the beauty of music, but in terms of the truth of music or the goodness of music, that's not even a conversation that we can have with so many people. That's what we've lost. We've lost the ability to have these conversations. We've lost the ability to make this case with regards to how much time you need on a weekly basis to train children, to train their affections, and to get them to understand music to a degree as a language in the context of training affections in the liberal arts that make this important. So what role then, point two, what role does music have in classical education and how should we teach music? So the first part is, I've alluded to this before, not just as narrative. We tend to start music appreciation with narrative pieces that then color the way we approach and understand subsequent music. This, once again, my intent is not to step on toes. Things that are programmatic music, Carnival of the Animals, Flight of the Bumblebee, so forth, have an immediate engagement that we can talk about things, but we also need to move beyond the fact that it's telling a story, because there are programmatic pieces, of course. We need to move beyond that it's telling a story, but how is it telling a story? How, in the context of the innate aspects of music and how music works, is the composer utilizing those elements to tell the story? How is he using color? How is he using the various aspects of rhythm or notes or range or instruments? Music is much greater than a conveyor of narrative. As I said before, the Lewis quote in Experiment and Criticism, we need to lay ourselves open to the art form of what music is, not just what we want to do with it, what we want to make of it. Tim Keller relates in his essay in the book, It Was Good, art has to have a place for the observer to explore and wrestle with the message. If the meaning of a work is apparent, allowing the audience with little effort to say, of course, this is what it means, and if the message can be simply stated in one sentence, the work is not art. You may have heard the famous statement by a dancer who was asked, what did the dance mean? She responded, if I could have said it, I wouldn't have had to dance it. Flannery O'Connor says something similar with regards to her stories. She says, people have a habit of saying, what is the theme of your story? And they expect you to give them a statement. The theme of my story is the economic pressure of the machines and the middle class, or some other such absurdity. And when they've got a statement like that, they go off happy and feel like it is no longer necessary to read the story. The point is that how a story is told is integral to the entirety of the art. Story cannot be reduced to theme or narrative. Music cannot be reduced to theme or narrative. Music acts as music. We need to be able to teach it that way and be able to have students learn it that way. And I kind of have a love-hate thing about using music as jingles to learn historical content, but that's another thing. Listening is an action, another point here. It's not background noise. We've become accustomed to being surrounded by music. There's music at the gas station. There's music at the grocery store. There's music in the elevator. Music has literally become amusement without thought, right? It surrounds us and we don't actually think about it. To be able to actually sit down and listen to something in its entirety and understand it as music, to set aside time to do so, to value it in such a way that we are setting aside time to listen to it as music, is not something that that our culture is used to. It's a commodity. It surrounds us in a way that becomes insipid. It discourages analysis. We get in the car and we flip on the radio. Or our students are, they get out of class and they stick in their earbuds. There's constant music, but there's not time for reflection. Music has become a way to cover the absence of noise, to cover silence. We're uncomfortable with silence. I used to tell students as an experiment to try driving their car without the radio on. And it kind of freaked some of them out for a while. Because we're not used to that. We're not used to being alone with our thoughts, ever. And to have the opportunity to actually, to understand silence, you can't understand music without understanding silence as well. And music comes out of that silence. It gives it a certain context. But when it's ubiquitous, you lose that aspect of it coming out of the silence. It's funny in the sense that, in a way that we have forgotten, marketers understand the power of music. far better than we do. You know, the type of music that a restaurant plays determines how long you're going to stay at the table. A certain type of restaurant that wants you to stay for a long time and order more beverages plays a certain type of music. A restaurant that wants you to move off the table so they can get another group in to get another tab going plays another certain type of music. They know the power of this. I mean, we know this innately. For a pep rally, you're not going to play Brahms' Lullaby. I hope. For nighttime music for your 3-year-old, you're not going to play rap. You know, Sousa. You know, we recognize innately that there's certain music appropriate for certain times because music affects us in those particular ways. Copeland says that, you know, in a sense, the ideal listener is both inside and outside of music at the same time. One of the things about music is that it happens in time. You know, it's constantly referring to itself and what has come before and what's going to happen, which also means that you really can't understand a piece of music with listening to it once. You know, if you ever read a novel for the second time and you realize that that thing that seemed to surprise the first time you read it was actually, you know, there was a trail there early on, the author was giving you hints. You know, a composer does that. That's the nature of music. If you just read that once or just listen to that once, you miss the whole context of what the artist, the author, or the composer is doing. Following music scores so that you're listening and seeing music at the same time, I think, is essential. We should understand that concept of the best art engages the intellect and the emotions. We're created heart, soul, and mind. It's not just a matter of what we enjoy, but being able to think through that. It should not be a passive activity. Copeland also says in his book, What to Listen For in Music, don't get the idea that the value of music is commensurate with its sensual appeal, or that the loveliest sounding music is made by the greatest composer. I kept this quote on your sheet. Music with dinner is an insult both to the cook and the violinist, said Chesterton. Also, choose only the best music. You want the best music to influence and to affect and to train your students. Think beyond the Baroque. You know, think from the standpoint that if you were to line up what most music appreciation curriculums teach, you're about on the, you know, 10-yard line of a football field, you know, heading to get the ball in. There's a good 80, 90 yards behind you of other music. From the very practical standpoint, and I remember this when I was in music school. In music history, you talk about basically the height of musical expression development is leading towards the symphony, which is a unique concert-going aesthetic, which is different from music that was written for the context of the church and everything that led up to that. Also, from the standpoint, too, the difference between... This is one of the things that happened within the context of Romanticism. That's when you have the retuning of instruments in terms of making the tuning pitch higher so you get a brighter sound, a louder sound. That's when you start getting larger orchestras. That's when you start having, you know, Handel's Messiah done by 300 singers as opposed to 30. It's when you start having Symphony of 1,000, you have Mahler, and how many excesses can we have in terms of, you know, the greater, the bigger, you know. Vocal sound can't compete with that. And so if you're going for these grandiose gestures which evoke emotional responses, choirs don't do that in the same way. Vocal music does not do that in the same way, especially a cappella music. And so you see this decline then of the presence of vocal music within the context of concerts, within the context of availability. It shifts to instrumental music as opposed to thousands of years of the history of vocal music that's written, beautifully written, to reflect a cosmic order, but also for the context of the church. It's one of the issues with Bach. You've got 200 extant cantatas, but they're too long for most of our church services, and they're too liturgical for a concert stage, and because most of them end with the congregational singing of the hymn, it doesn't end with a bang. You know, it doesn't have this emotional movement to the end, and so it doesn't fit our aesthetic of what a concert should be like, or what a concert work should be like. Because of that, you know, this beautiful music has lost, it's lost its place in the repertoire. You know, what Bach was doing in his cantatas is equal to or better than most of what Handel did. But that doesn't have the same kind of hearing or the same sort of repertoire. I'm sorry, moving from soapbox to soapbox. So then how do we decide what to sing and play? How do you learn a language? You know, you sing before you learn the theory. You know, you read books to your child before you teach them letters. You read poetry before you talk about meter. You introduce, once again, this is part of that enculturation. You introduce beautiful things. You train their affections to those things that are beautiful from early on. And you give them good stories. You give them good music, art to appreciate, to understand. And, you know, and I go back and forth too. You know, there's, I think most curriculums, most concepts begin with rhythm. But Alice Parker wrote a wonderful book on melody. Talks about the fact that perhaps melody should be the first element that we teach in music, because that's the foundation then of that conveys rhythm. Interesting argument. But in terms of talking about music too, I think we sometimes get lost in categories. The modern tendency is to classify music more by its lyric content rather than its kind. Think about pre-printed shelf. Well, does anybody go to a CD store? Does anybody know what a CD is anymore? Yeah, but when I used to go to CD stores, you know, you'd have the print, you'd have the labels for shelves, and you'd have, you know, pop music and rock music and soundtracks and classical music and so forth. But for instance, you know, pop, emo, alternative, new country, easy listening, contemporary Christian, hard rock are generally divided more by their words, but in actuality, from a musical perspective, they're all part of the same family. They're all very much akin to one another. What Garth Brooks is doing, and what you know, Queen is doing, is very much akin to what contemporary Christian music is doing. And this, from the standpoint of, you have a melody line, you have similar instrumentation, and a simplified harmony. That's not denigrating any of that. It's just to say that we usually think of those in separate categories, but they're actually much more the same. Similarly, because of perceived lack of lyrics, all orchestral, choral, polyphonic, liturgical, organ, and string music is often labeled as classical. Of course, I don't even like the classical music label. That's a period of music. I prefer art music as a genre, as opposed to specifically calling it classical music. So art music then would consist of music from the medieval period, Renaissance, Baroque, classical, romantic, neoclassical, neo-romantic, nationalistic movements, etc. Because they share those aspects that share common elements. And so you've got these different categories then, even how to think about these things. The other type of consideration for classification is the venue, the context, or the purpose of the music. For simplicity's sake, music can be divided by venue and context into popular music, art music, folk music, and liturgical music. And each of those four areas has distinctive aesthetic requirements based upon their various purposes. You know, a march serves a different function than a lullaby, but even minutely, a sanctus serves a different function than a Kyrie. You know, and the venue makes a difference. The aesthetic of worship is different than the aesthetic of a stadium concert and different than the aesthetic than a coffee house. I think from one perspective, from the church, because we have not understood those distinctives, and because we have not, as a church, enabled or encouraged the participation of music in those other venues, we have brought the music from those other venues within the context of worship, as opposed to understanding the distinctive theological aspect of a worship aesthetic versus a concert aesthetic. Which means, too, from the very perspective of, you know, how you play an organ, say, for an organ recital is different than how you play an organ to accompany congregational singing, or a guitar, or a piano, or whatever. There's a difference in how you would play those instruments because of the function, because of the different aesthetic. The second aspect there is voicing. Also gives a different perspective on understanding or appreciation. Is this a vocal work or an instrumental work? Solo instrument, full ensemble, is it a cappella? What instruments are used? And the last category is vertical or horizontal. vertical music is what we're used to. You know, it's the melody over chords, as opposed to more medieval Renaissance music, in which you have a horizontal aspect going on. You have multiple melodies going on at the same time, which is, you know, you have these beautiful crunchy moments in Renaissance music, because it makes sense horizontally within the context of the melody, but not vertically. It's not what we think of. The resultant harmony vertically is subservient to the horizontal movement of the melody, which is interesting. If you, as you introduce that type of music to students, when you get to those moments, they have real trouble with that, because they're used to that vertical aspect of music. The content of our singing says a lot about who we are and what we believe about education. You know, are there unintended consequences of the music that we sing and that we study? Do we undermine what we say we believe by the type of selections we make within the context of music program or the life of the school? And I would argue that the entire life of the school needs to be directed in the same focus. Hence my fable at the beginning. That it needs to be consistent. You know, you recognize the fact that students have every opportunity in the world to listen to the music that they like. Their educational setting is one of the rare spots that they have to be exposed to other music, right? And to encourage them and develop a love for things that they would not necessarily choose on their own. That's true across the board, but for some reason we get hung up on the idea of we need to do music that they like. We don't do that when we choose our literature. You know, we don't do that when we choose our math curriculum. You know, our students, there are students every once in a while who come along who have a natural proclivity for, you know, Shakespeare or Dante or, you know, something like that, and I'm going to read Homer on my own just for the fun of it. But more often than not, you have to lead them into those things, right? As schools, as communities of learning, we need to lead our students into things that they're not going to naturally choose themselves, and then to teach them why and how to enjoy those things. I think that's imperative, because that supports then what it is that we say we believe educationally. That's connected then into what we do in the other areas. We have to embody those things. I keep stumbling across this idea, you know, truth is not just a concept. You know, it's not just the intellectual activity. We just don't teach something. We just don't teach the fact that you ought to listen to Beethoven. You have to embody those things. You have to live those things out. Truth is not a concept. It's a person. You know, truth resides in Christ. And the beauty of how this connects to the quadrivium, Christ, who upholds the universe by the word of his power, has revealed himself in things that he's made. And music is one of the ways in which that is reflected. The aspect and the concept of and the context of music is reflective of the nature and character of God. So there's beautiful connecting points between history, between physics, between science, between math, that we can make in the context of music if we have the time to do that. If we have the opportunity within the course of the week to develop, you know, year by year a program in which we are leading students into to greater understanding. Part of that depends upon how we understand the role and purpose of music, as I said before. The greater understanding we have of this concept of music, the greater value that we're going to give it within the context of our curriculum, including the aspect of the truth and goodness which is embodied in music, not just the beauty. The implications of cosmic re-enchantment is music is formative. It will... not that it will form our students. Music is forming your students, period. Whether it's the music that you're teaching them, or the music that they're listening to, or the music that they hear at church, it is forming your students. It's forming their affections. It is forming their heart and their loves. Music matters. It is not an extracurricular. It's an essential part of a classical curriculum. It always has been. And it continues to need to be enlivened in that way. It's integral and essential. It's not a matter of preference, but is objective. I'm going to talk more about the idea of re-enchantment and the quadrivium on Saturday. what I hope to give you and instill in you is a greater appreciation and understanding for the importance of what you're doing, and the value of that. And to hopefully also give you some greater understanding and talking points to be able to encourage others around you, whether it be parents or administrators, about these things as well. And if you need to send administrators to me, you know, let me know. I'll be happy to field questions on that. But I think this is one of these areas in which I think we're lagging behind in our redeveloping of an understanding of classical education. And it's essential, I think, that we get this right. Not just because I'm a musician. I think one of the things about music teachers is it's too often too easy to dismiss your concerns as the fact that this is just your area. We need to set the narrative that this is not just your area, but is an integrated, essential part of the holistic concept of what we're doing as classical educators. And it's not just what you do, but the fact of how this plays into what everyone else is doing as well. We have a couple minutes for questions. Yes. No, that's a great question. How do we move teachers? Yeah, because teachers most often in education programs, in terms of learn to be teachers, aren't getting this either. I didn't get this in college. I mean, I remember in music history class, briefly mentioned the idea of the music of the spheres. I thought, hey, that's kind of cool. But it took 20 years to come back to that. It's like, oh, wait a minute. Not only is that really cool, that's kind of essential to the understanding. I think the starting point, number one, this is going to be a long time coming. This is not something that you just flip the switch on. It's like, wow, I understand this great new idea here. I think the first point is getting understanding of the re-enchantment of the cosmos, that it has meaning, that God has created the world with meaning and order, and it's knowable, and it's reflective of who he is. And to start there, then you start learning about other things. One example, too, and this works just across the board, not just with music. For example, the separation of the physical and the metaphysical has direct relationship to our understanding of ceremony and ritual. Why is modern folks uncomfortable with the idea of ceremony? Why do people get married in a field? Our understanding of symbolism, of sacraments, of covenant is truncated because we don't understand that the things that we see are created in such a way that they point to other spiritual realities. And so when you start learning and studying down that path, music is part of that. There are some sources here and there. There's no curriculum that I know of that works along those lines. I'm actually in conversation with somebody about that this week. But I think that's kind of the next step. I mean, we've spent a lot of time, beautifully so, in working on aspects of the trivium over the last 20, 30 years. There is so much more interest recently on the quadrivium, and I think it's essential that we understand that connecting point of how math and science and music fit within the context of a true classical liberal arts education. And that's kind of where we're moving, but it's not as easy. I think there's articles, there are some chapters and books, there's some understanding here and there, but it's also not the type of thing that you hand somebody a curriculum and say, hey, teach this. Because you've got to love that. You've got to see that and embody that and then move forward in that. No, not because. Partly because I haven't taught this level in a lot of years. I've been focusing more on the quadrivium aspect through New College and et cetera. So it's been. That's been more on my plate, to kind of that ending point, but not that building up point. But I'm open to suggestions on that for sure. Yeah. Sorry, that's not as helpful. Yeah. Yes. Mm. Yes. Yeah. I think, yeah, and it's bit by bit, too. It's you know, in terms of teaching parents and students and faculty, it's being consistent in thinking along these lines, even changing your thinking about how you make these decisions as a board or as administration or in the context of the classroom. You know, some of it may not change what you do as a music educator in terms of what pieces you teach or how you go about it, but it may change why you do it. You know, and that's going to influence, you know, the perspective on that. So it may not change so much, but other than the context of why you're going about it that way. So we're out of time. My email address is there. I'm certainly open for questions. One more question, maybe. Yeah. Thank you all so much.